And now to a new important study from the American Cancer Society. Deaths are down across the board, but
there is concerning news about cancer rates among adults under 50, especially when it comes to several types of cancers.
Colon cancer now the leading cause of death in men under 50, and second for women in the very same age groups.
Followed by breast cancer, which researchers say is also rising among women younger than age 50.
2 million Americans will be diagnosed with cancer this year.
That's the first time we've ever been over that number. And we're seeing some cancer trends that I think are really important for people to hear about.
20, 30 years ago, colorectal cancer in this specific age group was about the fourth highest cause of death. Now it's number one and two for men and women, respectively.
The possible reasons why are, you know, are all theoretical. You know, for one thing, obesity is increasing. So, it's linked to obesity, something in our diet, something in the environment. An interesting theory is the microbiome, you know, the trillions of bacteria, thousands of species in our gut. And there are certain types of species that seem to be linked to an increased risk for colon cancer. And we're changing our microbiome. We know that with antibiotics, with our diet.
And we're still seeing cancer disparities. You know, sadly, too many black women, too many black men are dying from cancer, many more than their white comrades.
Uterine cancer deaths on the rise, too. According to researchers, it's primarily due to racial disparities, leading to diagnoses at later stages.
The screening for colon cancer used to be 50, and now it's down to 45. Should it be even lower than that?
That's a good question.
I'm hearing more and more cases of men who are getting it under the age of 45.
42% of all these cancers are actually preventable. And what that has to do with is diet, exercise, you know, decreasing the rates of smoking and alcohol. So this uptick in the younger population, a lot of it is preventable if we alter our lifestyle early.
Now, for colon cancer, oncologists say the trends in the U.S. mirror those in other high-income countries and say it's possible the increase could be from new lifestyles or environmental exposures for younger generations.
More cancers than ever and popping up in younger and younger people. It's all over the news because the American Cancer Society confirmed that this is the case, and it's not good here. The Cancer Society also said there is a decrease in the risk of death from cancer. Now, that sounds good, but is that because cancer treatments are so much better? Or is it because we are screening more and discovering tumors at an earlier stage when we know it's easier to cure them? Tonight, we are going to dig into this question and a lot more with our own Dr. Paul Marek, who spent months studying cancer care and discovered what repurposed drugs can do to improve it, who wrote the brilliant FLCCC monograph, the book that you can buy on Amazon. It's there, Cancer Care, to help patients improve. And with him tonight, our special guest is Dr. Kathleen Ruddy, an internationally recognized breast cancer expert, a surgeon, and the founder and president of Breast Health and Healing, her own private practice in New Jersey, as well as founder of the Breast Health and Healing Foundation and much more. She's also conducting research and initiating projects that focus on how best to deal with the growing epidemic of breast cancer by trying to understand its causes to try to prevent this really awful disease. Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton. I'm creative director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals and their supporters. I ask questions, and so do you. In fact, you can type in questions for the doctors right now into the Q&A, and we have a nurse online who will answer many of them right online for you while the program is going on, and I might bring some of them back to the doctors when they finish the conversation about what's going on with the cancer numbers, with cancer prevention, and with cancer treatment. So let's bring the doctors out here. Paul, Kathleen, welcome. Welcome to the weekly update. And, you know, you see the patients. What is it? An epidemic is a strong word. You see this happening.
Well, I've been seeing it for 4 decades.
Wow.
I saw it firsthand in my own family when my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer in 1975. And then not too long after that, my brother was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I didn't realize it at the time, but that personal experience informed decision-making as I proceeded through medical education, and clearly informed my decision towards the middle of my surgical residency to specialize in breast cancer. So yeah, I've lived it. I've seen it. Yeah.
Have you seen a recent jump like the American Cancer Society is saying, and that question about the numbers and the improvement in deaths from cancer? Is that because the treatment's so wonderful?
Well, let's take that apart a bit. Let's just talk about incidence, okay? The number of new cases in a population within a specific age range. And the American Cancer Society data, to the best of my knowledge, has captured the information on cancer statistics through 2020, but not all of 2020 because there was a lockdown. So there is a bit of a hole, you know. It's always a retrospective assessment. I think a lot changed with COVID. I think we're just beginning to appreciate to what extent the profile of cancer incidence and prevalence, type, aggressiveness, ages in which it seems to be striking individuals. That has changed, in my view, from what I've seen. We don't really have good data. We've got the DMED data, of course, the Department of Medicine Epidemiology for the Department of Defense. And they clearly showed a moonshot increase in the number of cancer cases that were reported. Dr. Merrick pointed that out in his monograph. I think the number was something like 664% increase. Of course, the American Cancer Society and the NCI and the rest of them, the SEER data, they will not be able to capture that for another few years, but we have to capture it now because we have patients that we're dealing with. So that addresses the question of what are the trends in terms of the number of new cases. In terms of the efficacy of treatment, the narrative has been, since the ACS released their data, that the risk of cancer death has decreased. Fine, okay. The question that ought to be asked, and to the best of my knowledge, it has not been properly asked or addressed, is how much of that is represented by increased screening? Now we've got 75 million baby boomers, and they might not have been screened for this, that, or the other when they were in their 40s or their 50s, but we're now all past 65, okay? And they're getting screened like crazy, and for good reason. Professor Welch at Brown University has published several papers, but one in particular was published in 2014. And that was in JAM, I believe. And he's an epidemiologist and he does good work. And he did a retrospective analysis of the outcomes of women whose breast cancers were diagnosed because of mammogram screening. And he asked a few questions. One was, are you saving lives with this screening? Are you saving lives? The second thing is, what is the cost in terms of biopsies, false positives, sort of the grief and aggravation of an abnormal mammogram? And then he asked the question, was there a subset of these breast cancers that were diagnosed in women who had mammogram screening whose tumors behaved as if they were benign? So they were cancer. And I got into an argument with him because I was asked to debate him. And I said, I take exception to your vocabulary because he described it, and he continues to describe this, as overdiagnosis. That mammograms can provide an overdiagnosis of breast cancer. I disagree. I think that the pathologists know what they're doing. And if they diagnose a breast cancer, it's breast cancer. So it's not a matter of overdiagnosis. The challenge is to determine which of those cancers act as if they're benign. And so if you never found them, it would never be a problem. Well, at the time, and as of today, we don't have a way to distinguish the breast cancer that behaves as if it were benign from the breast cancer that would threaten a woman's life. So putting this all together, it's fair to say that we have more mammogram screening. And if we look to Professor Welch's data, that about 1%, I think the range was 0.3 to 1.4, so we'll say back of the envelope, 1% of the breast cancers found on mammogram screening behave as if they're benign, but we have no way of distinguishing which is which. Then you could move the needle on the number of cancer deaths. You could dial it back a bit, but it would not actually be because you had intervened in a way that was improving survival. And the last thing I will say is that I don't think that breast cancer and breast cancer screening is an exception. I think it's possible, it's a question that could be asked and answered, that colon cancer screening and skin cancer screening and the like might very well produce these small percentages of cancers accurately diagnosed, not overdiagnosed, that behave as if they're benign. It might not be a large percentage. Welch says 1% for breast cancers found on mammogram screening, but it's a large number of women, it's a large number of cases, and a small percentage of a large number is a big number. So I'm not sure that we have actually moved the needle in the right direction in terms of improving cancer survival.
So, Betsy, so just to add to what Dr. Reddy said is that, you know, she is right. The American Cancer Association data is from 2020. And so we know that there's been a big uptake in cancer. So they deliberately hiding that data. We know from the British data that was recently released that in the age group 16 to 44, there was a significant increase in the risk of cancer in 21 and 22. So we can expect to see a big uptake in cancer. And so I think there are many reasons. You know, one of them is the thing called the jab. We know that the jab increases the risk of turbo cancers. We also know there are other environmental factors and lifestyle factors. As you know, we said in introduction, is there's a strong link between obesity, insulin resistance, and cancer. And the risk of type 2 diabetes and obesity is going up. So I think the risk of cancer is going up. So it's projected that cancer will become the single most important cause of death in Western nations by 2030. And that one in two men and one in three women will develop a cancer in their lifetime. So we're really talking about a really important problem. Secondly, as one of the, you know, interviewers said in the beginning, there are many things people can do to reduce their risk of cancer. You know, obviously the most important is weight loss. Then there's such things as exercise, vitamin D, omega-3s, and healthy lifestyle is really important. So people can proactively take measures to reduce their risk. What is scary, though, and we don't know, is the turbo cancer, because clearly we know that the vaccine increases the risk. We know that for, you know, myocardial infarction and cardiac deaths, the risk extends for about a year after the last vaccine. In terms of cancer, we just don't know how long that risk lasts for. And so this is really troubling considering the number of young people that have been vaccinated. So, you know, we may be having an avalanche of cancer. Secondly, the impact that modern therapy has had is pretty abysmal, actually. You know, for some tumors, the outcome is not bad, particularly some of the hematological malignancies. But over the last 30 years, the impact, and I think Dr. Reddy would agree, the, you know, we've seen a significant decrease in the risk of death from cardiac disease, but from cancer, we just haven't seen the same trends. You know, people are still dying. The rates may have come down a little bit, but the number of people has gone up significantly. So it will become the commonest cause of death. And so that's why, you know, we have to be take measures to reduce the risk. And then as Dr. Ruddy and I will discuss today, there are alternative approaches to the treatment of cancer. Much like, you know, we were brought into the narrative of COVID, that there was one way only, you know, we're going to be talking about alternative therapies. And I think this is really what is so exciting, is that the oncologists don't want Americans to know. So I must say that, you know, in Europe, the oncologists are in many instances are integrative oncologists. They practice a more integrative approach, you know, both as an outpatient and in hospital. But in the US, you know, that is a rarity. And so Dr. Ruddy, what she's doing and what she is, what she represents, is a completely rare anomaly. But she's a, if I can say this, she's a traditional, you know, oncological surgeon who's now seen the light that there are alternative ways to treat cancer. Would that be correct, Dr. Ruddy?
Well, actually, I've always sort of been drawn to that alternative light. The first book I wrote was about the breast cancer virus. And just briefly, because this is really important to introduce to as many people as possible, I had had, I thought, the finest education known to man, and had done my fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and learned to really appreciate research and published peer-reviewed papers, all the best. And I was, you know, doing my fellowship with men and women who were writing textbooks. 5 or 6 years later, quite by accident, I discovered a paper written by the late Professor James Holland, Mount Sinai. And he had written a paper about the human breast cancer virus. And I'd never heard of it. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine who's a radiation oncologist had gone to a review while I was away somewhere. And he said, you know, Kathleen, you might be interested in this. And I was like, what? Stop the show. Breast cancer virus? So I looked at the paper and I was like, whoa, time out. And I called my medical librarian, Arlene Mangino, and I said, Arlene, please pull all of the references and then I said, you know what? Pull everything you can find. Okay. She came back to my office like 3 hours later. She had 100 years worth of research. And I was like, wait. Was I having a petit mal seizure when they were talking about the breast cancer virus? Was I out to lunch? Why do I not know about this 100 years of research on the breast cancer? I was like, whoa. And I checked my textbooks, you know, Rosen's textbook of pathology. It was nowhere. It was absolutely nowhere, but buried in the literature. So I said, okay, let's start, you know, Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, there was darkness. And I read the papers chronologically so that I could understand what these men and women were thinking from the beginning. And absolutely, there was no question that there, by the time I was reading the paper, Holland's paper, there was convergent, compelling data that there was a human breast cancer virus. It was responsible for a large majority, if not all, of breast cancer, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, I just need to do something about that. That's background. So when, fast forward to COVID, I thought I was coming to the end of my career as a breast cancer surgeon, but COVID broke out and I was like, okay, big problem. What can I do to help? I began prescribing ivermectin. Well, as a cancer surgeon, I'll tell you, we do not have a lot of experience with antiparasitic drugs. Okay, we just don't. And so I was like, what's with ivermectin? Why would an antiparasitic drug work against a virus? This I did not understand. So I began to look into it. And what did I find? There was research showing that ivermectin had potential as an anti-neoplastic, anti-cancer drug. And I was like, what? So I looked, 20 years of research. And I was like, okay, what am I going to do about this? Because I cannot just, first of all, can't retire. Second of all, I can't look the other way. Not when I was beginning to see in early days a bump in the number of patients with cancer. One thing led to another. And here we are today talking about the potential, the great, you know, almost Newtonian potential energy of these medications that could potentially be used effectively to treat patients with cancer, hopefully to improve their survival, and in some cases, to provide them with cures that they would not otherwise have.
I need to break in here because you mentioned that ivermectin there. And we already have a question from Laura Chamberlain, who says, please have both doctors discuss when to use ivermectin and when to use fabendazole, or the human equivalent for cancers.
Paul, over to you.
Yeah, okay. So that's a really good question. So it's a good question. We don't really know the answer. So what we do know is that both ivermectin and both mabendazole work for a broad array of tumors. They're very effective for prostate cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, hematological malignancies. And so they seem to work across the board. Now, it's important to stress they don't, it's not the antiparasitic activity. They work on specific biochemical pathways, which are somewhat unique to the cancer cell. So they interfere with metabolic pathways in the cancer cell and cause cancer cell death. They act on the cancer stem cells. They act on the tumor microenvironment. So unlike chemo, which really just targets rapidly dividing cells, both ivermectin and mabendazole seem to have multiple modes of action against multiple different cancer types. So the question is, we know, Dr. Reddy has pretty extensive experience using ivermectin. If you look at the literature, there's an expanding use of mabendazole. And so the question is, when do you use which and when do you use the other one? And so we're beginning to lean that you may want to use both. So Dr. Reddy will tell us what she does, because she's actually been involved in the treatment of a number of patients. And so she has a very logical, methodical way of looking at these patients. And so why don't you tell us what your experience is, Dr. Reddy, and then I will add to that.
Well, when I began to think, what could I do? Was there anything I could do to try and advance an answer to the question, do repurposed medications improve the survival of patients with cancer? Fortunately, my background in training allowed me to appreciate that where you begin to answer what is a complex question, you begin with observational data. So as I was trying to puzzle out, you know, what to do, I recalled the Framingham study. Most people are at least familiar with that. And the Framingham study was a study that was initiated and funded by the federal government going into Framingham, Massachusetts. They came in and they said, we would like to question you periodically, every 2 years, big questionnaire. We're not going to be telling you what to do. We'll be sharing information as we have it, but we just want to know what you all are doing. And we're going to follow you for years. It's been decades now. And they would go in every 2 years and they'd get the questionnaire. What they were able to do by simply doing an observational study, just going in there with a clipboard, taking down notes, they went in thinking several things which were erroneous, okay? So you always go into an observational study having a hypothesis, but being prepared to find things that you didn't expect and to be proven wrong about things that you thought you knew. They went in there thinking and having been told that hormone replacement therapy prevented heart disease in women and helped prevent Alzheimer's and was not associated with an increased risk of breast cancer. But they began finding out that that was not true on every count. Hormone replacement therapy increased your risk for heart disease, stroke, blood clots, and cancer. And so the Framingham study was able to identify what we call our signals, data signals. Having seen that, they could then turn the observational data over to their smart colleagues, and they would say, can you explain to us why perhaps there is not just a correlation, but causation between hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer? So they would go into the laboratory, the researchers would say, oh yeah, we understand. Oh, well, breast cancer is estrogen driven. Estrogens are promoters and they actually can trigger malignant transformation in some situations. Estrogen promotes the breast cancer virus, oh, by the way. And so that then returns as a feedback loop into the general public, and you begin to get a new view of the risks and the benefits and so forth. That happened with smoking, it happened with high fat diet, it happened with sedentary lifestyle. Okay, Framingham. So I thought, given the great challenge there is in trying to fund a clinical study using a repurposed medication that costs 10 cents a pill, that's never going to happen. And given the kind of negative feedback loops that were established for those physicians who were using ivermectin to treat patients with COVID, many of whom had their licenses suspended, whatever, big drama, I thought, well, probably would not be smart to start out by trying to arrange and fund a clinical study in which there was a protocol. How about an observational study? And I thought, okay, how can I do that? Okay, we don't need to go into the details, at least not here and now. But yeah, I sorted out how to launch a proper observational study in which patients who enroll in the study, by the way, it's participant funded. At the present time, it's not funded other than by the patients who enroll. They have chosen to at least become familiar with the range of repurposed medications and lifestyle changes and dietary changes, supplements, the whole thing. But mostly we're talking about patients who are coming in saying, I've heard about ivermectin, or I've heard about mebendazole. I would like to enroll in a study in which I can then both contribute my experience and glean from the participants any information which might be relevant. Fine. That's what the study is about. Now, if we see a signal, if there appears to be a survival advantage compared to historical data, because we've got plenty of historical data. We have plenty of people with stage 4 prostate cancer. We know how long they live. If they're told they have 3 weeks to live, how much longer do they live? Okay. And what happens? Do they have spontaneous remissions? What is the likelihood that someone with stage 4 prostate cancer told to go into hospice would have a spontaneous remission? Well, the likelihood that that would happen is not zero, but it approaches zero. So now if you get people in the study, for instance, and you're seeing these kinds of signals, you can, after a period of proper data collection and validation and oversight, I have an ethics review committee, the whole thing. If we see a signal, if the data would suggest, when the data are mature enough to analyze, and the data suggests that there's a signal here, there is a survival benefit, at that point, it then can be presented to our peers, the medical profession, not to be confused with the healthcare system. They're two different things, the medical profession. And we can begin to then convene a proper way to move forward into clinical studies to further elucidate and refine what we see in the observation study.
You know, may I jump in here again? Because you started talking about a breast cancer virus and then kind of left it off. And a lot of our people want to know, what? You know, what do we know about this?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So I don't want to bushwhack down that side of the mountain. I wrote a book about it. It's not a plug. Read the book. It's called The End of Breast Cancer, A Virus and the Hope for a Vaccine. Spells out the whole story. I think for our purposes of this call tonight and the webinar, I think what we want to say is there is a repository of untapped, valid data upon which to build a way out of our current stalemate. We've got a stalemate, and we may actually have more than a stalemate. We may have a real crisis. If the recent numbers hold up, then we are headed into the perfect storm of cancer cases. And furthermore, I have as a hypothesis that the textbooks and the protocols that were written for cancer, to the extent that they worked, have to be revised. I think that those books no longer apply to what we're seeing now. That's sort of my hunch. Okay, so, you know, it's not a peer-reviewed hunch. It's my hunch that what was tried and true is no longer as applicable, and in many cases, not applicable at all to the kinds of cancers that we're seeing now.
And so just to build on what Dr. Reddy said, you know, in terms of rewriting the textbook, the standard narrative is that cancer is a chromosomal disease and is due to specific mutations. And, you know, we've been through this. We know very well that cancer is largely a metabolic disease and that the mutations may be a secondary phenomenon, but is not what's driving the disease. And that's why the metabolic management and repurposed drugs are so effective, because they can target metabolic pathways that are deranged in the cancer cells. So I think that, you know, the current narrative is probably, for multiple reasons, is not correct, and the textbooks need to be rewritten. And, you know, obviously, we know what Dr. Reddy is doing is, you know, is phenomenal. She's really doing an observational study, much like the Framingham study, just looking at what's happening, collecting data, because I think that's, you know, that's what physicians do. That's how they diagnose, and that's how they make, you know, observations. You see what's going on, you put it together, and then you decide what to do. So I think, you know, she's going to collect a considerable number of patients, and we'll have a good idea of what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, so, you know, Dr. Reddy is using ivermectin, but as I understand, and she'll tell us, she also uses mebendazole and metformin and other drugs. You know, she monitors the patient and she adjusts the treatment accordingly, because I don't think there's a simple approach to all patients. Would you agree with that, Dr. Reddy?
Well, it's important, Paul, to include a critical clarification. As the principal investigator in an observational study, I'm not prescribing, I'm not providing medical advice. The patients come into the study either on ivermectin or they're taking fenbendazole. And I say, let's talk about that. Let's talk about these, let's talk about metformin, let's talk about fasting mimicking diet, let's talk about it all. You're the patient, you're the boss. You do not have to choose between the information that you are able to gather here and other choices you might make within your established healthcare network. So the patients are always making the decision. There are patients who say, you know, I just want to try ivermectin. Okay, fine. If they have a physician who's prescribing it, many of them do.
So could I interrupt, Dr. Reddy? I think, you know, maybe people don't understand how unique that is, that the patient actually makes decisions regarding their care. And the patients are empowered to do that. I mean, you're turning the healthcare system upside down, because the current way is the oncologist or the physician tells the patient what to do and they follow the oncologist. Here, the patients are in charge and they decide what treatment they desire, which is obviously empowerment of the patient.
Completely. They don't They appreciate it too, I have to tell you. They really do.
I have to go back though. Does this eliminate the need for removing breasts, for removing the tumors, for the awful cancer surgery that's there that's mutilating?
You want me to bushwhack down the other side of the mountain now? Okay. Because it had been established by the NSABP B4 study, B6 study, whatever study, in the middle of the last century, okay, when Paul and I were coming up in the medical profession, right? Yeah, it was established that surgery, by and large, breast cancer surgery, by and large, did not impart a survival advantage. They thought it did. Halstead removed the breast, the muscles of the chest, the skin, the lymph nodes. Urban at Memorial Sloan Kettering did a neck dissection. Nobody lived a day longer. They pulled back from the radical. They did a modified radical. And then both Fisher at the NCI and Baronese in Milan said, you know what, maybe we can do even less than that, because this is not a surgical problem. You want to debulk, but your life is saved with chemo. By and large, not saved with surgery. And so it became standard that all you really needed to do was to remove the lumpectomy, the tumor with a negative margin. It didn't need to be a big whack. It just needed to be a negative margin. That's all you needed to do. And that the patients had equivalent survivals. Well, the National Cancer Institute went so far as to say that that was the preferred method for treating breast cancer, breast conservation. Right. Now, all of a sudden, over the past 10 or 15 years, women are told, well, you know, you don't want to worry about it. Maybe you want to remove the entire breast because you don't want to worry about it. And if you're going to reconstruct that breast, let's remove the other breast so that the artificial breast that we've put there that you didn't need to have put there, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, we'll give you an equally artificial twin on the other side. Won't that be great? And women are buying it. And, you know, the plastic surgeons are lined up like planes waiting to land at O'Hare to get these women to remove all of this breast tissue unnecessarily. Okay, back on track.
I know someone who went through this. It was awful.
It is terrible. Mm-hmm. It's actually terrible. Yeah, and so when I finished my fellowship at Memorial, I created a breast service at the largest hospital system in New Jersey. And it was staff, God love them, with old school male surgeons. And they were removing everything in sight, you know. And I came in, you know, convicted about breast conservation and so on and so forth. I did 50% more breast conserving surgeries than the surgeons around me, and retrospectively, and had an order of magnitude better survival. There you go. That's anecdotal. But what is anecdotal? Anecdotal is a story with a point. The point was made by Fisher and by Veronese. You do not have to remove anything but the cancer. In most cases, if you have multi-center cancer, if you have a BRCA mutation, if you have inflammatory breast cancer, yes, but these are the minority of cases. The majority of women need to have the cancer removed with a negative margin, plus minus looking at the lymph node, depending on what kind of treatment that might produce. Maybe radiation, end of discussion, as far as surgery is concerned.
So then there's the chemo.
Yes.
That's the big thing.
Right. So let me just...
That'd be totally avoided by what you're doing with ivermectin and
fibendazole. Oh, who knows? I mean, I don't have that as a hypothesis. I mean, you, in an observational study, you're just going in there as if you were standing at an intersection and you're just recording traffic.
So basically, to answer your question, maybe Dr. Reddy can correct me, he says the patients decide. So obviously, you know, chemotherapy is not the most effective therapy for solid tumors and carries an enormous burden in terms of side effects, terrible side effects. So the patient can then decide, you know what, I'll have my surgery and maybe I'll have chemo, or maybe I'll just do some of these repurposed drugs. So the patient is actually in charge. And by doing it this way, as Dr. Reddy says, we're just looking. we're looking what happens, and then it can, you know, we will be able to see a signal. Does the chemotherapy make a difference? You know, does, because there is some data that ivermectin or mebendazole together with chemo may actually be better than chemo alone. So, you know, this will allow us to see what's happening. And obviously, this is, you know, such important data, which conventional medicine is not doing. And so that's why, you know, I think her observational study is groundbreaking. Because, you know, what better way to figure out what's happening but to look what's happening and see, see. See what's happening. Because we don't have all the answers, and that's what we're going to, you know, there are many questions, and we're going to try and answer some of them. We know absolutely that repurposed drugs and metabolic therapy have a role to play. You know, now, is that with or without chemo? You know, that's to be determined. But to a large extent, the patient is the one that can decide which pathway they want to follow. And so this is really a very exciting study. And for those listening, Dr. Reddy is going to be presenting at our conference, which is coming up really, really soon. And she's going to do a case presentation. And I think it will blow people's minds away just how potent some of these medications really are.
The preclinical data, the 20 years of research that Paul has reviewed and I've looked at, there is not a cancer type that has not been impinged upon in terms of its growth and proliferation when exposed to ivermectin. Not one.
Yeah, so that's really an astonishing thing. Yes, it's such an astonishing thing. Is that you have a antiparasitic drug, which is cheap and completely safe, that has data to show it affects almost every kind of cancer type. Isn't that truly astonishing? And you know what? It's a product of nature. You know, nature gave it to us. And so big pharma is really pissed because they can't patent it. Unless they can patent it, they're not interested, and you can't patent a natural product. So it's truly a blessing from heaven, ivermectin. So Pierre's probably listening to this, and he's just so excited.
Well, this is just incredible. There are a lot of good questions, and one of them deals with the diagnosis. We have a lot of questions for Dr. Ruddy on the thoughts on breast thermography versus mammography.
Right. So there are two different techniques of trying to smoke out the presence of malignancy. Cancers tend to be more metabolic. They have a higher metabolic rate, a fetus growing in the womb has a higher metabolic rate, right? So cancers tend to, not always, but they tend to. And if you have a higher metabolic rate, you're producing more energy. Energy becomes heat. You could detect heat. Okay. And I know that's very popular in women who do not want to expose themselves to the radiation that they would have to undergo having a screening mammogram. However, mammograms are able to use a technology that creates an image of what's there against a background. Now, if the background is very dense because you're young and you have dense breasts, that's normal, or you have dense breasts as sort of your background, it's harder to distinguish a cancer, which tends to be denser tissue because it's more proliferative, growing faster, close together. But as you get older, where the incidence and the risk of breast cancer increases, and the breast normally, especially postmenopausal, is more fatty. And so a dense cancer is easier to see. But there are other things that you can see on the mammogram that you're not going to see on thermography. ductal carcinoma in situ with the microcalcifications precedes a lot of cancers by about 5 years. So finding DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, on mammogram because of clustered microcalcifications gives you an advance on an invasive malignancy that would jeopardize your life. So I think the choice has to be the woman's choice. I think she needs to understand what the differences are. Certainly a mammogram is more specific. However, there are false positives there, and in thermography, false negatives. Could be a cancer there that you don't see. Then you introduce ultrasound, another way of imaging something that's buried in the breast three-dimensionally. So I think a good long talk with your physician or surgeon who knows about these things and can say, look, let's talk about your preference. What is your feeling about all of this? What are your risk factors? How old are you? Do you smoke? Are you diabetic? Do you have breast cancer in the family? Blah, blah, blah. Let's assess what your risk is. And then let's talk about the best way to find a breast cancer early if you're at an increased risk.
All right. Here's a question from Gerald, who asked Dr. Ruddy, do you have any ideas why oncology in general ignores speaking to both presidential commissions on the causes of cancer to focus on detection, and why the most important nutrient in preventing cancer, vitamin D, is rarely tested for?
I can't speak for them. I have no idea. I have no idea. All I can say is, look, the system is a profit-driven system. Okay, so you've got to make money. And you've got to make money pretty much all along the way. Even if you are embedded, you're employed. Even if you're employed, you say, well, I'm getting my whatever, X amount of money, you know, clock in, clock out. But nevertheless, you got someone breathing down your neck, someone with a BS degree or whatever, a BS degree, yeah, who is saying, oh, you have to see, you know, 6 patients an hour, and you have to chart for 4 minutes, whatever. So you've got the profit-driven system breathing down your neck. Where is the profit in understanding that breast cancer is caused by a virus? There was a profit in understanding that cervical cancer was caused by a virus. Why? Because cervical cancer was not a big cancer. And in fact, there wasn't as much money spent on diagnosis, and there was no race, right? You had cervical cancer, whatever, you got treated. However, when Zurhausen, after 10 years of being dissed, was able to show that HPV was necessary for cervical cancer, no virus, no cancer, and that you could develop a vaccine and that you could vaccinate all the women, all the girls and the boys, and you discovered that HPV is associated with 65% of head and neck cancer, now you got a bonanza. Okay, now we're into HPV. You take breast cancer diagnosis and treatment off the table. That's not like taking cervical cancer off the table. That's a big kahuna. Okay, you want to ride that one as long as you can. So there's that. There's that.
Well,
so Betsy, it's as Dr. Reddy says, it's the profit motive is that the system is driven by making money. It's not saving lives. And oncology and cancer therapy is extremely expensive. The average cost for chemotherapy is about $100,000 per year. So this is an enormous amount of money. And giving vitamin D to prevent cancer actually is a bad financial model for those who are exploiting the system and making money. So it's conflicting agendas. It's public health versus profiteering, which is simply the answer. I mean, the gentleman's absolutely correct. You know, vitamin D is being demonstrated over and over again to be highly effective in preventing cancer. It's an extremely cheap intervention, but who's making money from it? You can't patent vitamin D.
Well, let me ask you this. Christy Campagna asked, how does Dr. Ruddy feel about bioidentical hormones and cancer?
I think cancer doesn't care what that hormone looks like. That's my view. John Bittner discovered the breast cancer virus. When did he discover that, Betsy? How long ago did you think? Do you think Bittner discovered the existence of the breast cancer virus?
No idea. I couldn't guess.
1936.
Woo.
1936. And by the 1950s, 1960s, the National Cancer Institute was all in on researching tumor viruses, particularly the breast cancer virus. And in the congressional hearings in the run-up to the National Cancer Act, there Holland appeared, okay? There were a number of scientists who testified to the senators, and the senators who knew, because their staffers were telling them, there's a breast cancer virus. They're viruses that cause cancer. We should do this. Well, in comes Mary Lasker and Solomon Garb and Sidney Barber. Forget it. We don't need to know what causes cancer. We're going to cure it in 5 years. And that was the end of the cause. Bittner said, and I stand by Bittner, who was nominated twice for the Nobel Prize. He said there are three factors that you need to end up with a breast cancer. One is a genetic predisposition. And you're quite right, Paul, in saying that the genetic mutations in and of themselves do not guarantee, but there are genetic predispositions and whether they're there and then acted upon epigenetically, whatever. There's a genetic predisposition. There is the virus, no cancer, no virus, no cervical cancer. Okay. And then there are factors, cofactors that accelerate the malignant transformation in the presence of favorable genes, in the presence of this virus. What are these factors? Estrogen, progesterone, and things that act like that, the BPA, cigarette smoking, obesity, which increases your level of estrogen. So I know all about bioidentical estrogens. And I think if a woman chooses, because the patient is the boss, right? Okay. If a woman chooses and she says, you know what, I'm going to take my fat chance here. I want to take estrogen. I'm going crazy with these menopausal symptoms. Then you've made that decision, fine. And you want to choose the safest formulation, then you could talk to various physicians who have experience in this. And you might say, well, I would choose the bioidentical rather than the, you know, Robert Hall, if you remember Robert Hall from the 1960s, you know, off the shelf, off the rack, Premarin. So that's my view.
Yeah. If it's a virus, okay, mm-hmm. How did the vaccine industry miss this opportunity? About money. Talk about people going after doing something what they could try to vaccinate every woman in the world.
No, this is not a matter of missing. This is a matter of looking the other way.
Okay.
Deep sixing that whole question. No doubt in my mind. As a matter of fact, where was I? ASCO? No, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. A meeting where I ran into Holland, this revered professor of hematology, oncology, and virology at Mount Sinai, who had published sort of a summary of his life's work, was relegated to a poster, Paul, a poster at the end, the back corner, okay, of the poster section. He should have been giving the keynote address. And I ran into him because I was charging into the, you know, into the breach. And he looked at me and he says, good luck. He was 90 years old. He said, good luck. And I'm like, I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up on this. Nope.
It's just incredible. It's just incredible. Incredibly good news what you're saying. Here is another question from someone called Bella Zame. This is Professor Angus Dalglish in the UK, who has recognized the substantial post-vax increase in turbo cancers, has apparently had amazing results using a naturally derived
Mycobacterium immunotherapy. Do you know of that?
I do. I know of it. I've not had a chance to do a qualitative review by my standards of looking into it, but I did hear John Campbell interview him, and he's credible. And John does his homework. John does his homework. And he thought that the work that Dalgleish had done was also credible. There's something there to know more about. And I think as we open the space, and as really as frontline takes the leadership role in opening this space for the rest of us, it's gotta be like landing in Oz, okay? It was a black and white movie, and you land, and you're going through a tornado, and the door opens, and everything is in color, okay? And you're trying to find your way home, right? The cure. There are all kinds of things that need to be evaluated here. So that may be one of them.
Laurie Robb asks, what is the immunotherapy for cancer, specifically breast cancer, that has metastasized to the brain? This specific person had no doctor for 4 years other than a phone call. Thought she had shingles.
That's hard to say. That's a very specific, refined question. And I think we would need a lot more information. I think she wants an answer to her particular situation, which is reasonable. But without being able to do a comprehensive review of her medical record, which obviously we're not going to be able to do. I just have to respectfully decline to comment because I don't know.
Fair enough. I'm just looking to see what I have missed here. It looks like most of our people have gotten we have one here. Someone who goes under the and uses the term at my PayPal asks, should we continue to support the American Cancer Society for research?
Again, it's your choice. I think you've got to do your due diligence. You know, when I look at places to donate the money that I believe I am obligated to give back to charitable institutions, I look to see how much of the money goes to overhead, how much of the money goes to marketing, how are they spending their money? So as a matter of fact, we had a family tradition. My parents have since passed, but until then we had a family tradition. On Thanksgiving, we would, each person around the dining room table, it would be their year to choose the charity. And instead of exchanging Christmas gifts, one check, boom, went there. And one year, my sister Maureen said, make a wish. And I was like, I'd heard about Make a Wish. Then I learned more about it. Make a Wish is a great, great, great foundation. It's great. Okay. So I think, you know, you choose where you want to spend your money. Sometimes it might just be there's somebody that you know at church who's dealing with cancer and they can't afford their copays, they can't afford their deductible. They've got to pay $3,000 before they can start radiation therapy. Maybe that's where you send your money.
Yeah, so Betsy, it's a really good question. And I think you need to look what the American Cancer Association does. And largely they support pharma-directed research. And so I would be reluctant to, I think your money would be spent in better places. It's a really awkward question to answer, but I think that's the truth, is that, you know, they are perpetuating the narrative. It's like, would you want to make a donation to the NIH? You know, because you know what kind of research they do. It's really an unfortunate indictment of our system.
Let me tell you a quick anecdote about, a quick story about the American Cancer Society. It had another name. It was kind of a funky name. And Mary Lasker's husband, Albert Lasker, who was a big advertising magnate, changed it from whatever it was, wonky, to American Cancer Society. At the time, the director of now the ACS was the director of the laboratory at in Maine, Jackson Memorial Laboratory in Maine. And he was there when John Bittner was there. And he was there when John Bittner discovered and proved the existence of the breast cancer virus in mice. He was very well aware of it. It's a small building. And not too long after that, he was made the director, first president of the ACS, and completely ignored the existence of the breast cancer virus. That was not on the agenda, even though he knew that it absolutely existed. He knew it firsthand. He was supervising Bittner. He told three guys that, you know what, this breast cancer virus is passed from the female mice to her offspring. We know that. We can see that, observational data. He told three people, he said, you look at breast milk, you look at blood, and you look at something else. I forgot what the other one was. It's in the book. And Bittner found it in milk. Bittner proved that the breast cancer virus was shed in the breast milk of mothers who were infected with the virus. That virus got into the breast milk, got into the suckling, was tropic, found the breast ductal epithelium, and then grew during adolescence and produced more viruses. And if that mouse got pregnant, the virus went out in her breast milk. He proved it. Clarence knew about it, went to the ACS and made like he didn't know anything. So
that's just incredible.
So Betsy, you know, as people have figured out, Dr. Reddy is a world expert. She is an encyclopedia of information, and we are so proud to have her at our conference. We're going to be doing a two-hour session on cancer. Dr. Goodyear is going to join us, and it should be fascinating. We're going to have a really interesting case presentation, and we're going to talk about repurposed drugs, because that's where I think that's where the action is.
That's where the hope is.
I think it's twofold. It's what people can do to improve to reduce their risk of getting cancer. You know, so if you smoke, you want to stop. If you're obese, you want to lose weight. If you don't take vitamin D, you want to take vitamin D. You want to do all the right things to improve your chances. And then if you get cancer, you really want to consider, you know, repurposed drugs as part of the approach. And so we're going to address this at the conference. I think it's going to be really exciting.
All right. Final question. And how does the average person find Dr. Ruddy and find other doctors who will allow them to make the kind of choices that you do? This is just incredible. It sounds like the way it should be, but there has to be more than one of you.
Well, with the grace of God, there are going to be lots of us. Yeah, so the case that I'm going to be presenting, I refer as the case that launched 1,000 ships. And so I think wait a week and we'll all be there in Phoenix. And that will be the appropriate time for, I think, a fuller discussion. And I think you're going to find many physicians and surgeons come to the surface like a submarine. We're here. We're ready to pitch in and see what we can do to help.
So basically what Dr. Reddy does know is we've developed a special potion to actually clone her. No. We're going to clone Dr. Reddy.
My family will be appalled.
I love it. On that note, it's time to, well, I hate to end this one, but it's great. You'll be back. I know that. And of course, Paul, you're here. You're our expert for everything. Anyway, I have to give some messages to the folks at home to wrap this one up. And I thank, wow, what a great time. Thank you, Dr. Reddy. Thank you, Paul Marek. Now, as Paul just told you, you better come to Phoenix. If you want to hear more about this, you want to be there. It's just 9 days away. We'll all be in Phoenix, Arizona for our third FLCCC educational conference. This one about health care revolution, restoring the doctor-patient relationship. And boy, what better way than to have a doctor give you choices? Oh my goodness. We will showcase 2.5 days of incredible speakers, all experts in their fields, including Paul Merrick and Kathleen Ruddy. My goodness. And, you know, make sure to head over to flccc.net, the website, for a conference to learn more and, you know, save yourself a last minute seat. This is going to be an amazing conference. Now, we know also that many of you may not be able to, you know, change your plans at the last minute and get there in person. But if you would like to help support the healthcare revolution from afar, we are still looking for sponsors for our wonderful speakers. Your donation of $1,500 or more can help provide a speaker's transportation, hotel, and presentation at the conference. All donations are also tax deductible. You can learn more or make a donation by visiting the link on the screen. We thank you all so much for your help and for your support in bringing these amazing doctors and scientists, all experts, to where we plan to put good health into healthcare. All right. Webinar update. Just a reminder, there will be no weekly webinar next week, because we'll all be traveling to Phoenix for the big event, and no FLCCC news capsule next weekend for the same reason. We'll all be out there very busy, but we will be back the following week, February 7th, for an exciting recap to give you key insights and highlights of our, you know, favorite moments. And certainly there's going to be some from Kathleen Ruddy there. Same time, same place, in 2 weeks. But meanwhile, we have 2 new episodes from our wonderful doctors that you can see right now. Dr. J.P. Salibi's latest, Whole Body Health, looks at the symptoms, causes, and treatment options for immune thrombocytopenic purpura. That's a mouthful, but it's commonly known as ITP. It's an autoimmune disorder in which the immune system mistakenly attacks and destroys platelets. Sadly, doctors are seeing more cases of ITP these days. Now then, Dr. Bean's latest episode of Long Story Short continues the conversation about off-target proteins produced by mRNA vaccines and how they can cause harm. You can find both of these videos on our FLCCC Alliance, Rumble, and Odyssey channels, or on our website using the links on the screen. Now then, we have an announcement we must share with you today. Our beloved Dr. Bean's last episode of Long Story Short, at least for the time being, will be this Friday, as he will be stepping away to focus more on growing his own business. Now, we will miss these episodes dearly, but are so grateful to Dr. Bean for the incredible 86 episodes of this series, for his friendship, his knowledge, and for the life-saving information he continues to share with the world. We will continue to tell you about all the brilliant work that he will be doing. He is still a great friend of all of us here at the FLCCC. And with that, let's bring out another great friend, Samantha Hanks, our nurse who's been working tirelessly behind the scenes tonight to answer your clinical questions. Samantha, how did you manage by yourself? It had to be busy.
Yeah, I know. I miss Christina today, but no, there are a lot of great questions, but really were very specific for the doctors. So for Dr. Ruddy in particular. But oh, yeah. I do want to tell everybody that there are a lot of questions about ivermectin and any antiparasitics in treating cancers, and that really going to the website and going under the reviews and monographs, I really want to point people to that document because it's brilliantly done. It's so comprehensive and so many answers are there.
Wonderful.
So please go to the website, read Dr. Merrick's whole review of cancer research, prevention, treatment, all of it. It's all there.
Thank you, Samantha. Thank you for being here. Thank you for taking all those questions. Thank you for all the help that you give us. And we'll see you in Phoenix. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. All right. And finally, folks, you know, the one thing, you know, we couldn't do any of this without you. You are our FLCCC family. You know, thank you for supporting us in this mission, for helping us share the information far and wide, for helping us day in and day out, for helping us put on these events, for helping us create truly this healthcare revolution. There is just, you know, no way we could do it without you. And you're why, you are why we do what we do. The stories you tell us keep us going. And I want to say special thanks tonight. Don't sign off yet, because you want to hear Jessica Lombardo, who shared her story with us, and watch what she has done for patients with vaccine-related injuries. We will see you in 2 weeks, if not before, in Phoenix. So good night from me, but do watch just a couple little videos. Do watch what Jessica has to say. Thank you and good night.
The goal of all of this is just central to what we do. I mean, we're trying to help patients.
This is the battle to restore medicine to its original purpose.
This is the population of people that is creating a functional healthcare system parallel to the healthcare system that has failed us.
My name is Jessica Lombardo. I'm 44 years old, and I'm an American living in Amsterdam since 2005. I've been following COVID since the early days with growing disbelief. In December 2020, I saw Dr. Corey at the US Senate hearing testifying so bravely and honestly to bring ivermectin to light, only to have his testimony censored by YouTube as misinformation. On the back of this, I was following Dr. Andrew Hill, advisor to the World Health Organization, with hope based on his own social media posts, only to see him do a complete 180 due to a $40 million grant to his university in Liverpool from Unitaid, an organization that receives hundreds of millions from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I was and am enraged and saddened in the face of this widespread and unbelievable amount of crimes against humanity unfolding. Through the winter of 2021, I was following Real Not Rare every day and reading the heart-wrenching stories in disbelief at how horribly the medical community was shunning severely vaccine-injured individuals. One day in January 2022, I read a story that was so heartbreaking, I decided I needed to find that person and try to help her. She was a 30-year-old former ICU nurse who went from being an avid athlete and working double shifts in the ICU to feeling like she would die every day, having all of her medical community turn their back on her and being on the brink of suicide. In 2015, after developing debilitating neuropathy myself from a virus, I had a very successful experience with ozone therapy. So I sent her some information on the therapy. And being an ICU nurse in the conventional realm, she had never heard of it. Then I started reaching out to more vaccine injured victims every day. And by now I have been in direct contact with over 60 injured victims to varying degrees. And I've offered support via wider networks and support groups. These victims need to be heard, believed, supported, and treated. And sadly, they are not getting that from their healthcare system, government, or society in general at all. I provide support to let them know they are not alone, not crazy, not to blame, and that their body is a miracle and they should never give up on healing. I've helped set up fundraisers, connected victims with each other for support and coaching, and follow up on the tougher cases to keep hope alive. My loving family is also very fortunately in a position to every now and then offer financial support along with me to the victims, to FLCCC and other such platforms. I share treatment plans such as the FLCCC's iRecover, World Council for Health Detox Spike Intel, and functional medical practitioner protocols. I also encourage victims and coach them in fasting for cellular healing, which I was pleased to see as the number one recommended tool in FLCCC's protocol. To help arrange care, I locate and contact integrative or functional care clinics in the victim's vicinity and ask the relevant upfront questions, and I set up appointments. If they need it, I'll make sure the victims get key supplements, cover uninsured treatments, and send them healthy food. Lastly, I connected several victims to the REACT-19 Care Fund, who generously grant up to $10,000 per qualified victim in medical cost coverage. I've also held a REACT-19 Care fundraiser in my home. I believe this is my soul's purpose, and this is why I'm here on Earth today. Dr. Corey, Dr. Merrick, Kate, Christina, and all the FLCC Alliance caretakers are heroes for me, my family, and humanity, and we are honored to support you. Thank you.